Hi, welcome to another episode of the Leadership Enigma. I know I keep saying this, but we are roaring towards the 100 mark. Can't believe it. Tony's with me, roaring towards the 100 mark. Listen, change is something that is so difficult. People talk about how do you transform an organization? Actually, how do you transform people within the organization? Why does so much of this fail? So again, I've got someone that I've worked with before, a good friend and buddy, and someone who is way wiser than me, who can really help us understand people-centric transformation. Trust me, you do not want to miss this episode with the wonderful Professor Tony O'Driscoll from Duke University. Come back to me just after this.
During constant change, your leadership has never been more important to create a better and more inclusive world. You're listening to The Leadership Enigma, a podcast for the insatiably curious to explore the power of human-centered leadership to create real momentum for positive and sustainable change. Whether you're an entrepreneur, business owner, or corporate executive, each week we speak to global experts, academics, rising stars, ambitious upstarts, and disruptors as we discover that success leaves clues. Now, here's your host, Adam Pacifico.
There we go. It's a big warm welcome, Tony O'Driscoll from Duke University. How are you, sir?
Doing well, Adam, and you?
I am doing well, and I am loving the fact you are wearing that t-shirt. So I hope people can see that. The Superman t-shirt, and there's a real reason why you're wearing that. We'll come on to that, and certainly your book, Everyday Superhero, as well. But thanks so much for taking the time to join the Leadership Enigma. It's much appreciated.
Happy to be here, Adam.
Now, Tony, everybody has a story, and I just outlined very quickly that you're currently a professor at Duke University, the iconic university over there in North Carolina. But tell us a little bit about your story, because I know some of that story, but help the listeners understand that background story.
Wow, it's a long and varied one. I'm originally from Ireland, moved to America in 83 to go to university for 2 years, met a girl, ended up staying in the U.S., studied engineering. After about 2 years of engineering, I realized, where does the money come from my projects? And why is my boss such a pain in the butt? And, why did our stock go from $98 to 98 cents? And why is the company out of business right now? So that was I had a personal experience with disruption. And so that piqued my interest in why do companies fail and why do they disrupt and why can't they change and why can't they evolve? It was born out of pain, Adam.
Right.
And so, I was so curious, I went back to school and never stopped going back to school to study this very aspect of what is it about organizations, why can't they change, what is the problem, and particularly in the world we live in today, things are becoming more complex and more uncertain. The need for organizations to transform in perpetuity becomes increasingly important.
And that's really going to be the focus of our conversation. And I know the focus is going to be about the people-centric element as well, which is so important, something that really resonates with me. But help people understand a little bit about the role that you have at the moment within Duke, because I know there's a research element to it. And you tell us.
Right. So obviously you and I both worked at Duke CE, so I continue to have a research role there. And that was also built around the whole transformation initiative that we were running at Duke University. But more of my time now has been spent back as a traditional faculty. So I teach, classes on transformation, I teach a class on strategy, teach a class on org change, I teach a class on people analytics, I teach a class on global markets and institutions. So traditional academic role. But most of my research for the last 2 years, with the help of PMI, the Project Management Institute in the United States, has been looking at this particular transformational problem. And so there's been a lot more kind of wonky research and reports written, but the book is essentially just an outcropping of taking that research and putting into a more people-centered format, like a graphic novel.
Gotcha. And we're going to come on to the book in a moment. But tell me why that was the direction of travel. I know you mentioned it was born out of some pain a number of years ago, but especially now, because I assume you decided to go that direction pre-pandemic. And maybe the pandemic has even magnified the need for change. We're living and leading in the delta of change. So just help us understand how comes that became the priority for you at this moment.
Actually, I think ever since, honestly, since what happened to Nortel, to this day, some of my best friends worked at Nortel.
Yep.
We all agree it was the best company we ever worked for. We were allowed to fulfill our own personal mastery, amp ourselves up, autonomy, mastery, and purpose, as Dan Pink would say. And yet the company failed. We had better technology. We had engaged people. but we fell off the board.
Right.
Why? So it was kind of, you know, as an engineer, you have this crazy curiosity trying to figure out how things work. I just translated from trying to figure out how circuit boards work or how all the electrons are banging on this screen right now so I can see your face even though you're in England. I kind of know how all that works because it takes a lot of math to do that. But I took that same level of curiosity to try to figure out how is it that businesses can transform. And I'll tell you, it's far more difficult to figure that out than it is to figure out all this electronic stuff that we're taking advantage of today.
Do you know what? I've always been fascinated about that in you, Tony, because, you know, I've had the pleasure and privilege of working with you. And I know we did some projects together in Silicon Valley, which was great fun. Oh, those wonderful days. But I've always been fascinated and inspired by you, Tony, because you've been that technical engineer, but now you've made that transition over to trying to understand people. And I know you mentioned there's a real element of curiosity in you, but help us a little bit more to understand how you've gone from that real technical focus to now really trying to understand people, because when we come on to the people-centric transformation, that's the sweet spot, isn't it? It's all about the people. So how did that happen for you?
That would have happened when I was doing my master's work. I was looking at quality,
right?
And that was big movement at that Deming and Juran and all that, and putting total quality management systems in, and the Japanese were kicking the Americans butt in terms of automotive and so on and so
right.
forth. So I had a little bit of engineering to it, you know. It's like you could do your Ishikawa diagram. It had a whole bunch of methods that kind of made sense to a technical person. But I was fortunate enough to get to know some of the leaders. Joseph Juran was one of them. And that's when I was first introduced to Peter Drucker as well. And what I realized, it's the people, stupid. At the end of the day, you can have all the methodology, you can have all the technology and so on and so forth. But as Larry Prusak, who I also had the great fortune of working at when I was at IBM, is people make organizations stop or go.
Yep.
We'll stop.
It's,
I mean, if you take an organization, Adam, you know this. If you take an organization, you take the people out. All that's left is an inert set of machinery and tables, and you know, the people activate organizations, right? And so, you know, the research Allison Reynolds I think calls it the tyranny of the tangible. I think the world's become kind of so binary and ones and zeros and digital. And then we have a structure and a process and software. We have all these things that we're going to do to drive change.
Yeah.
But they're completely inert unless people themselves will change. So that's what got me into it. And then, of course, I went into IO Psych, an adult learning theory for my doctorate. So I really kind of went to the complete opposite end of the spectrum, because at the end of the day, I think, you know, it's about the people.
Well, I've now got to ask you, haven't I, because you're wearing that wonderful T-shirt, and I know we've got the graphic behind you. And you very kindly sent me, and I'm switching cameras here, this wonderful book, Everyday Superhero, How You Can Inspire Everyone and Create Real Change at Work. And I've thoroughly enjoyed this book, Tony, not because I know you, but that helps as well. It's because of all the leadership books, I'm an author of one, and I've got many behind me and have the opportunity to flick through and read lots, and lots get sent to me. This is very different, because if people can see here now, I'm going to go flick to the camera there, it's written almost in a story, comic book theme, in order to tell the story of the real research, because you've written academic papers on this, people-centric transformation. So I've got to ask the question, how did this wonderful book come about?
Yeah, that's an interesting story too. My life is full of interesting stories, Adam.
That's why we have you on the podcast.
As is yours. But as I said, PMI Brightline kind of sponsored this research, and their question was their question was very tangible. Why do 70% of transformations fail? Like, that's a pretty lossy number. They actually put a dollar figure on this. This was not my research. This is theirs. It's like $30 million a minute, or 2.3, it's equivalent to the GDP of Brazil, like $2.3 trillion is just wasted for companies that don't achieve the outcome they set themselves out to achieve, their desired aspiration. It just doesn't happen. Wow. We all talk about this in strategy. There's the intended strategy, and then there's the realized strategy, what we wanted to happen and what actually happened.
Gotcha.
In that is a huge amount of loss. So they're saying, you know, as a professional entity who's building project managers, who essentially are the engine room of most organizations, if 70% of the time the realized strategy isn't being executed, right? Executed means one of two things: to kill or to do.
Okay.
Unfortunately, strategies get killed 70% of the time. So they asked, why? What's the research saying about what's causing this kind of pretty bad number, if you think about it? And so for a year and a half, I got to go dive into the literature, try to understand what the latest thinking was from a whole number of different arenas and try to put that together. And the bottom line there was, it's people stupid. Organizations don't change unless people change.
Yep.
And it's really hard to get people to change. And I know that because every year for the last 10 years, I've committed myself to going to the gym and I'm still fat. Right? So there you go.
You heard it here first. I want to just frame this because I was looking at some of the documentation you sent through and thank you for that. But mm-hmm. framing just the extent of the problem, and I'm taking this from your research. So since mm-hmm. 2000, over half of the Fortune 500 have gone.
Mm-hmm.
There's a prediction that 75% of the S&P will be replaced within 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then that statistic you talked about, failure rate for organizational transformation over the last 15 years is sitting somewhere between 60 to 90%. Tony, mm-hmm. that's bonkers. Have we all gone mad?
Yeah, and unfortunately, so there's three different sources for that. So the first source is Martin Rees and the Henderson Institute's yep. research, where they've been kind of tracking organizational longevity. The second one there is Innosight, which is Scott Anthony and his crew out of Harvard, who essentially have been looking at corporate longevity for the last 20 years.
Right.
And then the third one is from Robin Speculand, who has been looking at strategy implementation over the last two decades. The unfortunate thing is I just had Robin come speak to my class. And with digital transformation, we were seeing the failure rate getting better. In other words, we were going from 90% failure rate to 70% failure rate.
Right.
So great, we've gotten better. It's still 7 out of 10 don't work.
Yeah.
But now it's ticked back up.
Wow.
And the reason it's ticked back up is when we start doing digital transformation, one of the problems with digital transformation is we tend to automate the past, bad assumptions and all. Drucker called that the routinization trap. So we're increasing the efficiency with which we suck rather than changing to something we need to be. So what's happening is disruption's going up and companies need to reimagine themselves.
Right.
But instead of reimagining themselves, they're like, no, we're doing digital transformation. We're implementing whatever, technology X, process Y. But we're doing it to automate our existing model when our existing model may not actually live.
Is this something also about using yesterday's logic to try and solve you know, what we're heading towards? I mean, so this is a big, big problem, not just in relation to a dollar sign, but just think about the emotional, physical expenditure from people, because we're going to come back to people again. And obviously, you know, there's a lot of conversation around the last 2 years. I'm going to ask you in a moment how the last 2 years have been for you. But the last 2 years, the great attrition, the great retention, the great reflection, and so many labels are coming out. Mm-hmm. But I think what it's highlighted is people are now voting with their feet.
Yeah.
So if they're in an environment of constant change, of constant failure, of a culture that they don't believe in, that there's no real force for good or a passion for what they do, people will leave.
Mm-hmm.
So this has become even more important, hasn't it?
Absolutely. So I just, again, in my class, I had Gary Bowles come in, who's at the Singularity Institute. He's the future of work. He runs the future of work.
Okay.
And I think I'll integrate for me personally is like, for me personally, and I think for most people, is you had forced time for reflection. And you also had kind of a little bit of removal from the work context. And what I'm finding with my students is, you know, they're saying is meaning is the new money. I used to think, you know, they're going to Duke University, it's a prestigious university. I want to get a job on Wall Street. I want to get a job as a consultant.
Yep.
But now that I've had some time to reflect, it's like, boy, the world needs sustainable outcomes. The world needs, you know, there's so much of the world. God forbid, I might even think about going into politics, MBA types, right?
That's another episode.
You know, we've had that time to kind of personally reflect and ask ourselves the tough meaning questions, the existential questions. We've all become kind of amateur philosophers, I think. And I think organizations really need to pay attention to that, because if there's not alignment around a shared aspiration, and that you can't bring people along with that, and you don't have that kind of hidden superpower of discretionary effort, what people do because they want to, not because they're told to. It's do not pass go, do not collect $100. It's a non-starter. And so I think the great resignation, or whatever it's being called today, is real, and it's a trend. And you know, it'll normalize over time and people will find their place. But there's also, as you and I were just talking, there's so much more opportunity to be a free agent in this increasingly LinkedIn connected podcasty world, right? Everybody can brand.
It has changed.
Their own thing.
Now, I know we're slowly segueing into some of the components that make up the people-centric transformation model. So let me move to that now, because that is the focus really of the research that you've done. And I think it's incredibly powerful, because I've always believed it's people first. And I know that you talk about people first as well. So can you just give us an overview of the kind of people-centered transformation framework? And if it helps, Tony, I can actually put it up on the screen. Does that assist as well? And we can, I know our listeners can't see it as they're listening to it, but we can talk through it. And then we'll also make sure that we get these videos out as well, so people can see that too. So let me just pop that up on the screen and pop myself in the corner there, so I don't in any way interfere with that model. But tell us a little bit about, and what are we looking at now? You'll have to describe it well, because most people are listening to this, not watching this.
Yeah. So the first thing around this, I'll tell you, you know, the idea, if you've ever seen a native Indian dream catcher, that was kind of part of the idea here, is it's that this is a non-linear thing, because most organizations are complex adaptive systems, are not machines. So that's my first kind of thing, is we've been trying to fine tune the machine. And what we need to do now is nurture the relationships, the network of relationships, because I think organizations are nothing but networks of relationships. So there's no start here and end here. There are just like 10 elements that need to be activated by leadership shifts, very small leadership shifts that ultimately nudge the organization forward towards shared aspiration, alignment around a shared aspiration, autonomy for people to do what they know how to do, and accountability to get it done so that the overall agenda of the organization moves forward. So I call that the four A's: aspiration, alignment, autonomy, and accountability. You get those four, what you get is an agile enterprise, one that can move and adapt in perpetuity, because change theory is no longer, you know, unfreeze the organization, reconfigure it into a new structure, a new go-to-market, or a new whatever way you want to do it, organized by product, organized by go-to-market, organized by geography, and then refreeze.
Gotcha.
There's no refreeze anymore.
No.
There's just Tom. Sense and respond and sense and respond and sense and respond. So you can't really, and the other thing is, there's no single leader on the planet, including Elon Musk, who can figure out where the world's going. Like, you know, there's just too much to process. So none of us is as smart as all of us. Therefore, we need to really engage all of us to kind of find our way forward together in a more emergent way. That begins with shared aspiration. It begins that we collectively have an aspiration to go somewhere together, right? And that we're aligned around that aspiration. We're aligned around the outcome we're looking for. And that we feel that we have the autonomy to contribute our best selves to that aspiration, and that we are accountable to delivering our best selves to that aspiration in the collective. And if we can get those four pieces, the four A's, working together, we will move forward.
Okay. So as people are listening to this, and I'm just popping it back up on the screen, the four A's: alignment, accountability, autonomy, and aspiration, and all of those as you have within the diagram. And I'm going to ask you how people can connect with you and get some of this material, because they should, they must actually. That nudges the culture. And then, as you say, there are 10 components. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. There's 9. I suppose nudge the culture is the 10th.
Nudge is the 10th, yeah.
Nudge
is kind of an outcome, if you will.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay, so as you look at the 9 within the circle of nudge the culture, where should we start? Where would you like to start? Do you think maybe a critical piece that people need to understand or certainly take into account?
Yeah. Well, there is a little bit, like the reason that communicate a compelling change narrative is in the core, is in the middle,
and the other
two, which are embrace situational humility and act to think differently. I see those as kind of foundational, right? Let me give you an example. You know, when Martin Luther King made his address, he didn't say, "I have a plan." Because if he'd said, "I have a plan," and he whipped out a Gantt chart, we wouldn't have achieved the civil liberty that, you know, there's still a ways to go. But yep. I think that this was particularly a moment. I'm being USA, if Churchill hadn't said certain things, if Mother Teresa hadn't said certain things, if JFK hadn't said, "Ask not what you know your country can do for you," there are moments that kind of catalyze. Catalyze is a very interesting word for me. Catalyze means you get a better outcome or you move quicker by not using up more resource. So there's something inherent in that catalytic equation that mobilizes people. Yeah. I believe that what mobilizes people is discretionary effort. People must believe that the achievement of a shared aspiration is possible, it could happen, and worthy of their effort before they're going to make it happen. So to me, in plain English, yep, it's belief before behavior. If I don't believe that this change is worth doing, I'm not going to change my behavior to make it happen. And if organizations are nothing but people, and people make companies stop or go, if people don't believe, they're not going to behave in a new and different way. They're going to stick to the status quo.
Now, this really resonates, and I'm making notes on top of my original notes as well, Tony, which is why I love doing these podcasts, because I learn a lot. So it's about communicating, and the word I'm going to emphasize deliberately is compelling change narrative. Mm-hmm. And you gave some examples thereof, and sometimes it's use of language and the charisma and the character and the context, but it has to be compelling. And is that linking in then to belief before behavior, that people Correct. Actually say, I feel that, I buy into that, I'm behind that, therefore I believe in it, much to do maybe with purpose of organizations and how they retain good talent.
So the word compelling means you're compelled to do it. There's almost a part of you that's like, can't stop doing it. You're drawn towards it. That's what I mean by, you know, a clear and compelling narrative. And it's also narrative. We as human beings process through story.
Right.
We want to know, what's the story? I'm from Ireland. That's what we say to each other when we first meet. Hey, what's the story? Right. We don't say, what's the spreadsheet? We say, what's the story? Tell me what's going on. What's the story of your life right now? And I think that the leaders that can catalyze belief around a change state can communicate it in a clear and compelling way. And compelling means I'm compelled to do it. I'm with you. And to me, leadership, there's only one requirement for leadership. There's so many books about leadership and so on and so forth. Adam, you and I spent a lot of time looking at it. I've come to believe there's only one thing. One condition dictates that leadership is present, right, and that's that you have a follower. So I actually think that leadership is about engendering followership. And I think the first step to engendering followership is to have a clear and compelling change narrative.
And let me follow on from that, because there's a phrase you've used that some people might be mulling over at the moment. And you talked about catalyze the network. And I think I read in one of your documents that don't control and command and control we now. Yes, there's a place for that, or a time for that, or context for that, but that's not the way forward. Don't control, but catalyze the system. And you talked about sensing, connecting, and activating. Tell us a little bit more about this catalyzing the network, about how people are, in some ways, are able to drive or compel that network or that system to do stuff.
Yeah, this is actually a great one. Each one of these elements relies on research in a different domain. Okay. This one about catalyzing the network, it is born a little bit on the traditional change literature, Rosebeth Moss Kanter, and more recently, John Cotter's new book, Accelerate. And essentially what John is saying, which I agree with completely, is the idea that, you know, in a world where it's very adaptive, a hierarchy doesn't work. A network works.
Yeah.
And he goes back to when Facebook was founded, or when GE was founded, it was a small network of people who knew each other well, who trusted each other. And then it grew into this big, large enterprise. And then as you get bigger, your focus goes from outside to inside, because you're trying to get your whole process to work. As Jack Welch actually said, when the speed on the outside is greater than the speed on the inside,
he's
talking about a company,
it's the curtains, end is right?
Neat. Yeah. You have to have this synchronicity of being able to kind of adapt with the shifts and change and acceleration of the marketplace you operate in. That works better through a network. Even, I had the great benefit of interviewing General Marty Dempsey the other day, and he's saying, even in military context, right now, and particularly in cyber,
yep,
a network beats a hierarchy. In other words, it's just a better suited structure to have to deal with ambiguity, right?
Right.
And in fact, if you think about the internet, it was developed by DARPA as a flat topological structure that didn't have hierarchy, so that even if Chicago got taken out, we could communicate between New York and San Francisco. So we know, just from a structure perspective, networks are more resilient and adaptive. So you need an ambidextrous organization, right? And a whole bunch of other research that talks about you need the hierarchy to get things done and to execute in the known universe, yes, right? And to deliver
in the day-to-day.
In the day-to-day, and yep, to get stuff done and to do so with the right margin. But that same process doesn't find you your next S-curve, doesn't find you your next whale, doesn't find you your next, you know, landscape of opportunity. The network does. And so catalyzing a network is one part of the system, and then optimizing the hierarchy is another. They are not, it's not like you're going to completely create a network in your organization. You need to have both, and you need to know when to turn one on and when to turn the other one on. And so change used to be driving change down. We're going to reorganize, or yeah, we're going to implement a system, or we're going to apply a new process. TQM was all about applying a whole new set of processes to kind of manage variance in manufacturing, right? But now what's happening is there's a thing that I call, in my other research, I call it responsiveness lag. The bigger you get, the slower you are. So your structure process is always going to be out of phase with the market reality. The market's moving quickly.
Yes.
And it's like companies are trying to keep up. So you're always going to be kind of sort of out of phase, you as a firm, with that. And you say, okay, we're going to come in and reorg. And by the time that you come in and reorg,
done it again.
The market's moved again. The market's not sitting around saying, okay, hurry up, get yourself in shape. I'm kind of, it's like the tortoise and the hare kind of problem. So then is it a bit of a fallacy to always be trying to reorg? Or can we just kind of operate in a more networked way like Hollywood does? Right. Hollywood doesn't have they have production studios, but then it's the Steven Spielbergs of the world who bring together different sets of capability around a different story with a different lighting engineer and a different cinematographer to create an asset that creates value. And then they disband. And he goes on to the next project and pulls together. The world is kind of, the gig economy, you know, is moving in that direction. I even had another CEO come in and talk to my class recently, who's in charge of the largest staffing organization, back to your great resignation question, in the US. And he said, you know, our old model was finding people for jobs. So they'd have a client like an IBM or a Merck or whatever, Microsoft, and say, hey, we need X amount of engineers.
Yep.
And that was their job. He said, I think our new job is to find jobs for people. We're going to become the Jerry Maguire agent for Adam Pacifico, and we're going to find him the cool things that he wants to do to feed his curiosity and get paid. And oh, by the way, maybe you want to spend the summer down in New Zealand. Well, we can find you a job there too. So now we'll have these virtual agents who essentially know what it is we want to do and learn about, and kind of leverage the power of AI to look across the marketplace and see where there's a value match. So that's the notion of kind of catalyzing a network.
Gotcha.
Is how do you do that?
And so many leaders who are wise, experienced, and maybe of a certain age are going to have to challenge many assumptions and biases, aren't they, in order to really be able to thrive in this environment that you're describing.
That's the hardest part and the most important part.
Right.
So, if I go to nudge the culture, which is kind of, that goes to my own experience. So I was in IBM during the Lou Gerstner years.
Right.
Right. And I'll remember this, I'll tie this to the network story. At IBM, we were doing a lot of experimentation way back in the day about, shared collective environments before any of this Facebook stuff existed. And we call them jams. We would invite all 360,000 people in. We would ask them, we create little prizes like, hey, here's a $10 million prize if you got an idea where you think IBM's capability could do good for humanity.
Right.
And then we kind of upvote it. We used kind of an upvote system. And so these were called IBM jams. And since then, IBM's gone on to offer that to other companies as well.
Okay.
And Lou Gerstner at the time said he approved it. And to be honest, at the beginning, the jams weren't going very well. We weren't getting as many people online as we wanted. So we went to Lou and we said, hey, Lou, could you just go on and make a couple of comments? Right. And I don't know, I was involved in this, but I wasn't in the room. So I can't say definitively, but I think there was a little resistance. He went on, Adam, and just started to comment, and the whole thing catalyzed. You know what I'm saying? So I think this is the trick. There's still a hierarchy and we still look to leadership.
Yes.
You see what I mean? And it's in leadership demonstrating change behavior that you can actually catalyze into the new direction. But the challenge is, you put your finger right on the pulse there, that requires that the leader let go of everything that they know.
Yes.
And step into the abyss. And I'll quote something from General Dempsey, because
sure,
I think it's very apropos here. It's one of my favorite sayings from him. He said, leadership is stepping into the breach of uncertainty, confident in your team's ability to deal with any eventuality. that's what leadership means to him. Because particularly now in the world we're dealing with, even with what's going on in Ukraine, nobody knows what's around the corner. But you're confident in your team's ability to deal with any event. We have the right diversity of perspective, diversity of insight, diversity of expertise to make sense of what's happening and then to move forward. So it's almost like jazz, not orchestra.
Tony, as well, there's something that fascinates me. And if I think about your very technical, proficient, expert background as an engineer, are you finding now that in the work that you're doing at Duke within leadership and working with not only students, but also very senior leaders who come and chat to you, that now the leadership are having to rotate away from the technical expertise that they spent a lot of time, effort and money gaining and relying on, and now going over towards and leaving that with some courage to go towards the skills that we're talking about, that courage, that humility, that vulnerability, that ability to catalyze, to communicate, to compel, to, and people call them soft skills, which I hate because I think they're desperately difficult. But are you finding now that leadership has got to start to understand the benefit of those skills above and beyond the technical skills?
It's a yes and there, Adam.
Okay.
I think we now get into the realm of what you and I, you know, worked on when we were together at CE, is this notion of the center leader and leadership as a system. So instead of, I think in our minds, we always tend to think of a leader, like I just mentioned, Martin Luther King or Mother Teresa or, you know, Ada Lovelace or Sam Palmisano, you know, or Jack Welch. So we personify leadership and it's about position, you know, the person in charge. Like we look at Thomas Edison and say, what a great, you know, inventor he was. He invented the light bulb. Well, he didn't. Menlo Park, the whole environment that he created, it was kind of this petri dish of kind of ferment. That's what made it happen. And it wasn't the light bulb. It was the system of electricity to fuel the light bulb that made it work. A light bulb by itself is not worth anything. So when you scratch at the surface, Barbara Kellerman's done this research. There's kind of something that's called the leadership attribution error. We overly ascribe the success of a firm to one human being who typically sits at the top.
Right. Which is unfair.
I think, you know, they are leaders. Just as I said with Lou Gerstner, if he had not jumped into the jam to open up and unlock the discretionary for the people, it would not have happened because he's the leader. Okay. And in modeling the behavior that was okay to say what you wanted on this platform, then he unleashed the Kraken, so to speak. But it required him as a leader to do that, to give permission to others to do it. You see what I'm saying? So my kind of view on leadership is that if you go back to my earlier comment that leadership requires followership. I think leadership and followership are far more fluid and dynamic today than they were before, and they're not anchored purely to position.
Okay.
You see what I mean?
I do.
So I'll give you an example that ties these two things together. One of the technical things about catalyzing the network, Adam, as you know, I do a lot of work in social network analysis, organizational network analysis.
Yes.
So that's instead of looking at the hierarchy, you can ask people a whole bunch of questions where you can actually literally depict what the network of relationships are.
See where the influencers are.
With. Yeah. Like you and I, we get a lot of energy working together, right? Who do you go to have an ethical question about the morality of a particular business decision? Who would you give your work to if you had to go away for 2 months? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Who would you follow into the fire, right? Now, let's just go on that one. Who would you follow into the fire? This is real research that we did with that same staffing company.
Yeah.
Here's the deal. 30% of the people that were identified as somebody I would follow into the fire, I would walk off a cliff with this person, were not on any succession plan for leadership inside the organization.
Wow.
And a good 20% of the people who were in the hierarchy were not earmarked as someone would follow. So if you think about that...
There's a disconnect there, isn't there?
There's a disconnect between kind of the hierarchical... If you buy that leadership requires followership, which... I think that's hard to argue, right? Otherwise, you're not a leader. And then you start to ask the question of who would you follow in a certain circumstance or who do you get energy working with? You can start to get a much richer picture of the reality of the relationship set in the organization. And then you can use that. You can find who the catalysts are. You can find who the hidden leaders are. You can find who the flight risks are. You can find who the energy network is. Rob Cross, who's a friend and colleague, did a whole bunch of work with McKinsey. And with McKinsey, they don't have a hard time hiring people. They, you know, they can get, quote unquote, the pick of the litter from the best schools.
Right.
And yet there were teams that completely outperformed. I mean, 10x outperformed the average teams. And what Rob found was it was energy. The question was, who do you really enjoy working with? Who do you really get a buzz when you work with? You know what I mean? It's like a sports game. It's like, you know, probably you had the CEO for a sports game. There's something like you're in the flow.
Yeah.
And we all work really well together. Well, if you know that and you can identify who it is that does that, you can unlock a whole lot of discretionary. That's findable, outable today. If I take my geek side and put that back on.
Well,
I mean? That's catalyzing.
I hardly have that conversation about organizational network analysis. Are you finding you're doing that for a lot of companies or still too few?
Still way too few. I mean, if you look at Deloitte's latest reports,
yeah,
I think 2 years ago, they were saying that 45% of companies in their survey were dabbling with it. They were kind of trying it around the edges. It's getting more currency. And what you're finding now is, you know, platforms like Teams.
Yep.
I've got some rudimentary, Adam's connected to Tony through text or through meetings we've been on, so on and so forth. So they're doing a different type of analysis. They're looking at the digital communication. That's one way you can do an O&A.
Yep.
The other way is to do a census and ask people these very specific questions. I like to do it that way because I think it's cleaner. Who are the five people that you would hand your work over to right now if you had to leave for 2 months?
I think that's a fascinating question.
That's an execution network. Yeah.
Well, and with your permission, I'm going to start asking people that question. Who would you actually follow into the fire with? And it will be interesting to see, you know, who they say or certainly what they think. Tony, can I ask you a question? If I put up the center leader model, can I just ask you to explain that? Because that's something that I talk about to other people, because I was always fascinated by that when you first created it and introduced it in relation to how the center of an organization or the center leader or the middle manager, I don't know, you'll help me with definitions, are a real dynamo for change. And if I put this onto the screen now, I think you can see that, and I'll just take that off. But you talk about the center leader is in the interface between strategy, results, culture, and people. And again, I'll ask you for your best contact so people can reach out and either see this on the video or get it from you. But just help us understand what we're looking at the moment, the middle out, the adaptive leadership system.
Yeah, so if I'm being 100% transparent, which with you is easy to do, Adam, I am a nerd, right? And I don't know if you ever watched the show Silicon Valley.
Yes.
Silicon Valley is
startup
culture and so on and so forth. Well, you know, the thing that I really like about Silicon Valley as an engineer, right, is that they're very good in when they talk about the technical stuff. And as a geek, I understand that. But there was one episode where they were talking about this whole new architecture that they were going to do. And it wasn't a top-down architecture. It wasn't a bottom-up architecture. It was a middle-out architecture.
Right.
That's really interesting. So this model was kind of born out of, you know, the moral of the story here is watch a lot of Silicon Valley.
There we go. You were inspired by. I do love it. It is a great program.
Because you never think about that. You think about, you know, a data hierarchy that's up and down. I'm not going to geek out too much. But so I started to think about it. And I said, you know, if you wanted to think, I think about organizations as networks of relationships. I start to say, okay, if you think about that, or also if you think about strategy, because I teach a lot of strategy, and we think about value network analysis rather than value chain analysis, which is the new way you think about ecosystems, it all comes down to the nodes in the network.
Yep.
When you're looking at nodes in a network, and this also goes back to my telecom background, because I used to design, you know, networks, telephone networks, is the biggest nodes in the networks and where are the points of failure? And so the question here is, if you took X person out, could the whole system collapse?
Okay.
And if you look at it, the people who sit in the center are not dinosaurs. We always say, oh, the middle layer is dinosaurs and we can wipe them out and we can have information technology take it over. But where they sit and the perspective that they have is, if a strategy comes down from on high, right, from the mahogany offices,
yep,
and then they're pushing, this shows up in the book a lot because May is the center leader.
Yeah.
And then it hits the troops, you know, or it hits the factory floor, or it hits the army of consultants. And they're like, what is this? It's never going to work. The first person who knows that is the center lead. They know, right, immediately that it's DOA. It's dead on arrival.
Yeah.
But they rarely, you know, they rarely architect, transform, do the same model we used to use at CE. they don't have a channel back up
to put it.
I mean, imagine it's like early detection. If I have a diagnostic that tells me I'm going to get colon cancer, and I do it 5 years ahead, I could save my life. It's a similar thing here. The center leader is sitting there knowing it's dead on arrival, but doesn't feel that they have the autonomy to be able to say so.
Gotcha.
to call a spade, so to speak. And similarly, they are the culture keepers. They understand who are the ones who are, you know, the culture keepers, and they also know what their people want. So they sit at this nexus where their perspective is really the pulse of the organization.
Right.
Right. If I'm too far up, I'm worried about financials and talking to Wall Street. If I'm too far down, I'm worried about a paycheck and where my kid's going to go to school. You know, that manifests itself in a culture that's either going to be resisting change or not resisting change. And at the end of the day, if I'm not taking care of my people, they're going to walk out the door.
Gotcha.
Who is better positioned in the organizational system than those who sit in the middle? So I believe that we need to lead from the middle out, right? That's the notion of center leader.
And I'm assuming that there are many leaders, and I know there was some research from the Work Trends Analysis that actually said a lot of leaders are out of touch. And they're out of touch even more so because of the pandemic, which in some ways makes that even a bigger issue, because now they're completely out of touch with that dynamo part of the business, that center leader part of the business. And if they're completely detached from it, then the problem's even larger, isn't it, Tony?
Agreed. And I would say, you know, that model is almost drawn like a propeller.
Yep.
Like you're trying to, again, back to compeller, propel, moving forward. I think that the axis around which that forward momentum, you know, goes is around a network of center leaders who truly do have the pulse of the organization. Is the strategy on point? I don't mean in terms of making money. I mean in terms of people share that aspiration and are aligned around it, right? And are we culturally ready? Do we have belief before behavior to make that happen? Or are we going to have to do something to adjust our behavior, leadership first, in order to have the right kind of culture for us to move that way? And are we doing so in a way that honors our people, particularly now coming out of COVID? I just can't understand how there can't be the cohort of people who have that gestalt understanding are those who sit in the middle. So I've never been a proponent of, like you said, I've always believed that those who sit in the middle are dynamos, not dinosaurs.
Right. I mean, there are so many learning nuggets from this episode. There really are. So let me ask you, firstly, thank you very much for sending me this. I thoroughly enjoyed it, but maybe a silly question, but where can people get the book, Everyday Superhero?
Well, it's in UK and the rest of the world, not the US yet. It's on Amazon. So you can just go on Amazon.
Gotcha.
You can order it on Amazon if you're in the United States, but it won't actually physically be available for distribution in the United States till August 1st. That's a problem about a container falling off a ship. That's probably too long.
I know. You did tell me about that, didn't you? Yeah. Well, there are 10,000 copies at the bottom of the ocean. I perish the thought. I hope not. So this is out and coming out. Will be widely available. So the other thing is you've kindly shared some documents, and the research that you're doing is incredibly relevant. It's so relevant. Mm-hmm. And so how can people connect? What's the best way, Tony, for them to continue the dialogue, learn more, get some of this information, and be part of the dialogue? I don't know how.
Yeah, so I have a site. It's called the complexsimple.com.
complexsimple.com.
Either one of those two will get you to the same site. All of my articles, all my research, some excerpts from my speaking, and of course I've written two other books, but this particular book there, all of that is available up there.
Brilliant. I think that's wonderful. Now, let me ask you a completely unfair question, which I ask so many people, and that was, especially in the current climate, so maybe make this context specific. What's the most powerful piece of leadership advice that you've given or received that really comes to front of mind for you?
Be humble.
Tell me a little bit more.
I think that we tend to believe that leadership is about kind of, there's the hill, take the hill. Right. But I think a lot of the more recent research, you know, is about situational humility. Nobody knows what's going on.
No.
And the sooner you can kind of acknowledge that and tap into the wisdom of the crowd so we can find a shared way forward. But if you are in a position of power, just like the Lou Gerstner story I told you, you almost want to convey it's under control. You know, the old keep calm and carry on. I've got this. I understand. The paradox is, if you're relying as a leader on 20 years of experience, you're like, I remember this is just like back in the year 2000 when Y2K was coming. It's not a big deal.
Yeah.
That is flawed flawed logic, because the year 2000 is not the year 2022. And so how circumstance conspired for the outcome that you had at that time does not translate to this. No. So I think this is the tricky part of leadership. In one point in time, it's kind of like what General Dempsey is, you're stepping into the breach of uncertainty. But it's not like, I got this, follow me. It's confident in your team's ability to deal with any eventuality. That's the trick, is do I have a constellation of capability and mutual respect with a shared aspiration where leadership can move or evolve, but we are moving forward together towards an aspiration we share, right? That's a very different model of leadership that requires that you lead sometimes, you follow sometimes, you listen more, you speak more. And I think about it like jazz, Adam. I think that the organization's going to have to become more like a whole series of jazz players who can join in and play and create something beautiful and move forward, rather than a preset musical score and orchestra, because the world is too unpredictable.
Tony, love that. Love that. It's been a real pleasure to reconnect. Long overdue. Absolutely fantastic to see you, chat to you. I'm glad we were able to have this conversation, that people know how to reach out and connect. I hope you've enjoyed the experience of the Leadership Enigma.
I want to come back like tomorrow.
We will do it, because I know that you'll be working on different things.
Adam, how's that?
Deal. Can you imagine?
It's a date already.
The 200th. I tell you what, it'd be lovely if you will come back later on in the year, because you're at the cutting edge with your academic research and the work that you're doing and the people that you're meeting and the iconic leaders who are coming in to talk to your students as well at Duke. It would be wonderful if you would consider coming back, and we'll take this a little bit further.
It's a date, my friend.
Thanks for being a superstar.
Alrighty. Join us again next week for more tips and strategies on the Leadership Enigma. We'd love to hear your comments on today's show, as well as suggestions for future topics and guests. Get in touch with your host on LinkedIn or our YouTube channel. And remember to get your daily learning to build success at www.insights.emeritus.org. Download the Insights app and start learning for free. Please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on all your major podcast platforms. Thanks for listening.